Hack the chat.
I started off with a movie called Trees.
Apparently, a great white pine has staked...
which was a shot-for-shot parody of Jaws, starring a lumberjack, a botanist, and a forest ranger versus a great white pine.
I'm talking about finding a great white pine.
You're gonna need a bigger axe.
So we copied every scene of Jaws, made this really awful guerrilla filmmaking, terrible music, Jaws parody, and Blockbuster bought a ton of copies of it.
It was a tree.
And that kind of got me started in movies. And then we did a sequel called The Root of All Evil that we thought we would hit out of the park.
The town of Hazelville is apparently being besieged by hordes of killer Christmas trees.
And nobody wanted it.
We're here today talking to Synthetic Cinema International co-founder and producer Andrew Gernhard, along with director-producer Colin Thays, about how this Connecticut-based production company got its start making horror movies and has now cornered the market making holiday films. I'm Sarah Lemire, and this is Hack the Chat. Well, why Jaws? Why that film of all films? Are you a Steven Spielberg fan?
Well, when I first got into movies, I was like, oh, I want to be Steven Spielberg, and not realizing that that's the impossible dream to be Steven Spielberg, because there is only one Steven Spielberg, and nobody can even come close to getting anywhere near his success. But Jaws was one of my favorite movies, still is one of my favorite movies, but my favorite movie is Ghostbusters. Ghostbusters 1984, not 2016, though there's nothing wrong with 2016. I think it's a fine film. You know, Jaws was just a great film that I liked, my partner at the time, Mike, liked, and we thought, oh, let's make it because it could be funny. And it was a simple story. You know, Jaws, where I think a lot of movies now, they focus on the creature. You know, Jaws was really not about the shark. It was about the three main characters and their interaction and how the story developed around them, their families, the town. And then the shark was just the driving motion of it all. And that's where they got it wrong in all the sequels to Jaws, because it was all about the shark. And that's where people are like, oh, Jaws 2 was okay, but then Jaws 3 was awful. Then Jaws the Revenge was even more awful because they had like a proton gun or something. That the shark jumped out of the water. It was awful. But it's just Jaws is one of my favorite movies.
It is a great film. And you're right. It's so character driven. I think that's what makes the entire film. And there's some great lines. Do you have a favorite? Everyone has a favorite Jaws line. What's yours?
Oh, God. I feel like I'm a mixture of Peter Venkman, James Bond, and Doctor Who. So I always quote these lines. I quote them to people who don't know movies, so it's good. So I think it's my line. I always say, for some reason, I always like mumble, you all know me. You know my business. I'll catch this whatever for you. And, you know, it's like, you know, there's a lot of fun lines. But the scary thing is, you know, kids think like Jaws is like an antique film.
It's true.
Because it was old when I was growing up. And now it's like, it's basically like something from the 1930s to what everybody thinks it is now. It's bizarre.
How about you, Colin? What was like the first inspiring film that you saw?
Oh, gosh. I've been watching movies as long as I can remember. My parents started taking me to movies when I was like one. I think I saw Harold and Maude when I was like probably barely old enough to look at the screen. Actually, I just recently saw the re-release of 2001. When I was young, I used to have had a copy of that on VHS, and I would like play back and forth the first scene where the ship docks with the space station, and I used to build copies of little ships out of toothpicks and tinfoil and try to like shoot my own like space scene with like a piece of roof asphalt and like blending images together with a video board. In the school announcements room, trying to figure out how to do like that kind of effect stuff. I don't know if I could name one in particular movie that totally, but that was an important one for me. And seeing it again recently reminded me of how much I loved that when I was little.
It is a great film. I just watched it with my college age daughters, and they loved it right up until the end.
Oh, yeah.
And then it ended, and then everyone went, "What?
Yeah.
That's the end?" But that I think is the brilliance of Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even watching that this time, I was like, if this came out now, I would hate it.
Exactly.
I do appreciate some of the stuff that it does really well.
It does. I mean, it was groundbreaking at its, you know, in its time, it still is. I mean, I think it's a forerunner for all the science fiction that came after it. And so how did you two meet? I mean, so Synthetic Cinema, when did that actually begin and how did you two meet?
That'll be fast into it. So after I did Root of All Evil and it didn't sell, I kind of got out of doing movies entirely because I was like, oh, this is awful. We put a lot of work into this and busted our butt. Nobody wanted it. So I kind of got into graphic design.
Natural progression.
Yeah, I was working out in the Farmington area on graphic design and stuff like that. And a bunch of distributors kept calling me saying, when are you doing your next movie? Because they remember Trees. And that's when the DVD boom started to hit Blockbuster Video. Everybody wanted DVDs. They wanted monster movies. And so in my spare time, we came up with an idea called Hell's Beacon, based on what distributors wanted. Not what audience wanted. Not what I wanted. It was what 12 people at Blockbuster were going to buy. Because there's 12 buyers for Blockbuster, which are 8,000 stores at the time, which I know people can't believe, that only these 12 people decided what goes on the shelves. And you know, of course, they bought all the big movies and all the big indie films, but all they wanted was monster movies. And they said, okay, you got to have, you know, hot guys and girls, bikinis, monsters, explosions. They gave us all this, like, basically a cookie cutter of what they wanted. Again, not what I wanted, not what the audience wanted. So I teamed up with this guy, Chuck, and we wrote a script called Hell's Beacon, which is about a meteorite that crash lands on an island with a bunch of bikini girls and guys, and the meteorite opens up and it can emulate their bodies. The way to save special effects is you emulate humans and only turn into a monster part of the time. And, you know, I had a lot of guns and fighting. It was a truly awful film. And I didn't have any money. You know, I had this idea to do this film. Chuck and I had this idea, and we wrote the script and didn't have any money. I went back to Rich Lucas, who was the head of the communications department at Southern. He knew people with money. He knew investors. And I said, hey, you know, I want to make this movie. I think I can sell it because I have distributors looking for it. It's exactly what they want. And he took the script, and I talked to him and his wife, Bonnie. They talked about it for a couple weeks. And he came back, and he's like, you know, he goes, yeah, I think we can get this funded. And I was like, oh, great. He's like, but we're going to fund it, him and his wife. But I don't want to do one movie. I want to start a company. And we started Synthetic Cinema. From there, and the reason we called it Synthetic Cinema was because we didn't believe they're real movies, and I still don't believe they're real movies. So it's a synthetic cinema. And we made this movie called Hell's Beacon. We shot it over the weekends for a couple weeks, you know, a crew of six people, really awful movie. And 2 weeks after we finished post-production, Universal Studios Home Video saw an article on it and bought it. And it immediately was released on, you know, to Blockbuster, Hollywood Video, Tommy K's Video, if people locally remember that. You know, it was all over the place. And then we started a string of monster movies based on werewolves and killer Amish people and all that type of stuff. And we met Colin because Colin was just getting out of college, and I'll probably remember everything wrong because I'm old. And he applied for an internship, and I know he was like the super computer CGI kind of guy, and we had a werewolf movie called Lycan, which Lionsgate bought and turned it into Werewolf the Devil's Hound. It was another awful movie. But Colin did all these amazing digital effects for it that were like, holy cow, the werewolf can now jump, you know, 50 feet, and like, it can do all this crazy stuff.
I still don't know why you took me, because I remember I showed up and just talked about what camera you should buy and how I didn't like the camera you were using.
And that's the way to do it.
Start of a beautiful relationship.
Most people that we end up hiring, I'm either afraid of, or they're weird, or they're awful. Like even John Doolin, who's a screenwriter for us, he tried to intern with me for, I think, 3 years, but I didn't take him in because I thought he was the guy from American Psycho.
He'd be proud of that.
I was petrified of him because he came in and he was just scary. And I was like, I don't know if we want him around because he's really creepy. But he's a great screenwriter. He's a great guy. Yeah. He would be happy about that. But that's how Colin got involved. And then Colin was Banshee right after Lycan?
Yeah. So I was there. We did Lycan. I was an intern that year. And then I went back and finished my senior year. And after that, I came back to do Banshee after I graduated.
So how many horror films in total have you worked on together?
I can't remember how many movies we've done, to tell you the truth. It's all blurred into one now. We started off doing horror and creature feature stuff, and it went from home video, then it went to the Chiller Network and Sci-Fi, and then Lifetime and Telemundo, and now Hallmark. But you know, they've gone to Netflix and Amazon and Hulu, so we've had them all in all the different outlets.
I think the key is that thing you said before about, you know, you're not making necessarily what you want to make or what the audience wants. You're making what the distributor wants, because they're the ones who really are the economic driver of whether an individual project actually gets seen or not.
Yeah.
So what gets made changes over time based on what people want to buy.
Yeah.
Well, and that's probably the most complicated part of a film is not coming up with the concept or shooting it, but finding someone to distribute it. Is that really kind of the back channel thing that most people don't know about making a film?
Yeah.
Is you have to find somebody who's willing to invest and then distribute your project.
And it's even tougher. You know, I brought this. It's when I first started in movies, not many people, I mean, a lot of people made movies and indie films and stuff, but not many people did because the technology wasn't affordable or easy. Like, it's like when I first got, you know, it was tape. It was hard to make. It was expensive to make. But now, you know, I always say filmmakers are killing filmmakers. So many people are getting into movies that no matter what level of talent you have, you can make a movie. And anybody can say that they're a producer or director, which drives me crazy. Because it's like, oh, I'm a producer. It's like, okay, well, what have you done? Have you been paid for it? Have you done this? So there's a lot of that going around in the industry that, you know, is kind of crazy. I think it's the only industry where you can, like, make up what you are. Where, like, I couldn't go in and be like, oh, yeah, I'm going to build this house. I'm in construction, and I'll build it for a quarter of the price.
Yeah. Well, we have gotten over the years, a lot of people come and ask, like, how, you know, they want advice on how to make a movie. And you're like, okay, so who's it for? Like, who's your buyer? They're like, what are you talking about? Blair Witch Project sold for, that one always comes up.
Blair Witch always came up for a while. Sure.
And it's like, you wouldn't open a pizza place if you didn't know who bought pizza. Like,
yeah.
You know, it's like you have to think of it like an actual company. And yeah. There definitely are a lot of people who don't think of it that way. They just are like, I want to make a movie and...
Yeah.
That's the end.
And that's, you know, it's you got to really enjoy making movies. You really want to make movies. You really want it to be like a business rather than just, I don't know, whatever people think. We've run into some strange people over the years on what they think movies are and what the movie business is. And I think the other thing is,
changed so much.
Yeah, to me, movie, TVs, everything changes every 6 months. There's something new. So you can't get stuck in this rut of this works. You have to constantly be changing because the studios are constantly changing. The networks are everything's changing all the time.
Well, and let's talk about that because in the age of Netflix, nothing is the same. And you see people leaving the theaters in droves because it's so much easier to stay home and watch 12 hours of Stranger Things than it is to pay $60 for popcorn and listen to the people talk behind you for 2 hours. So, I mean, in a new world of streaming services, how does that game change what making films looks like?
I think we've only really started to see the beginning of the effect of that. Certainly, there's a ton more stuff being made right now than there was previously, especially in television. It's had a real revolutionary effect on television. But in practice, it's also meant there's just a ton more stuff, a ton more outlets, and it's led to a very hyper-focused, hyper-targeted market where it's like far fewer viewers see any given thing. Like, I know if you go at a holiday and see your whole family, everyone's like, oh, I'm watching this and I'm watching... No one's watching the same show. They don't even know what the other shows they're talking about are. And they're all like big budget, high-end, like Emmy nominated shows. And just no one's seen any of them because there's just too many shows. So it's like, you know, there's a show designed just for your demographic and like no one else watches it.
Is that a bad thing, though?
It's not a bad thing.
I mean,
thing.
I think
it's a
that creates
thing.
Diversity and yeah. allows yeah. people to find their niche and what they're watching.
I think the future is going to be these niche markets.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like you're making movies for horror, you're making movies for this person. I think that's where it is. The question is, and I think there is the money to support it because now groups are so huge. You know, they're so diverse. And I think there is, you know, there was a way to make money. But the audience, you're talking about the audience, it's weird what people think. Because people don't know movies. Like I was just talking about Daredevil earlier. You know, I had people come in and you know, watch Daredevil. Like my mom watches Daredevil. She thinks it's low budget. She's like, it's not, it's so dark and the camera's always moving. It looks like garbage. I was like, really? So people's perspectives of movies are so, anything that looks huge, my mom thinks is cheap. And I find a lot of older people think, oh, if the camera's handheld, that means it's cheap. I was like, really? I mean, Daredevil's probably, what, $3 million an episode, if not more? I mean, I don't know their books, but it's huge.
Well, how does... So shows like Daredevil or House of Cards or anything that is going on for 8, 9, 10 episodes, there's so much more time to develop plot, characters, a script. How does that impact you as filmmakers? Because in many ways, you're still sort of beholden to the 2-hour time limit, or even less if it's for television and there are commercials inserted. So how does that change what you do with so little time to develop a script?
Interestingly, I feel like the whole streaming thing has really affected television a lot more than movies. Movies are kind of in an interesting place. They've kind of gone through a lull on the indie side and are coming back a little bit now, thanks partially to things like MoviePass, which I wish would stick around. But I mean, personally, I prefer the movie format. They say TV is a writer's medium and movies are a director's medium because a movie is more about like polishing the visual side of it, and a television series has so much more time to develop story and character. But usually it's shot somewhat more standardly, even if it's great. Like it could be really high quality, but usually it's a pretty you know, once you get a routine of a coverage pattern, you stick with it. You're just telling the story. It's more narratively efficient or visually efficient, I guess.
Well, I think actors are loving all these new formats.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, with like Netflix and Hulu, because they're able to do, they can do movie level stuff, but a little bit more off the beaten path, a little bit more edgy, a little bit more interesting. So it's not like, oh, here's the movie formula or here's the typical, you know, cable or network standard. Like Netflix allows them to be more creative with, like, I don't think Daredevil could ever be on TV.
I can't claim credit for this thought, but I heard someone recently say, like, you know, it's changed and that you would never expect to read every good book that came out, even if you love books. But people have expected for many years to watch every good show. And it's like that you can't do that anymore. There's just too much of it. And it's a transition period. I mean, it's always a transition period, but we're in a particularly strong one, both in a content distribution audience side of things and in a production side. Like, we watched the digitization of cameras, yeah. And now we're seeing lighting change to LED, which is equally a substantial impact on the actual production process. And, you know, it allows you to do so much more with so much less and or do the same thing way faster, which is what everyone actually chooses.
Even in just speaking about the change of stuff, we did a movie. The last movie when we first got into business, we used to have to bring either big generators or do power drops. We used to go contact a town and be like, hey, City of Norwich, we need to draw power to do lights. Now, no joke, all of our lights, more powerful, more lights, are run off of tiny generators or batteries. They're LEDs. And it's like, so you're getting, you know, basically two or three trucks worth of lighting you can get into one now. It's a lot easier. And even with the cameras, like, I mean, I don't wish to be a teenager now due to social media now, but I wish I had an iPhone growing up because my movies would be so awesome.
Oh, right.
You know, to be, I mean, the iPhone is ridiculous. It's unbelievable. Like, I would just make movies. Get this for me. I will do my homework, my movies, everything off this one device. And
but
that's
at the same time,
amazing.
You might not have actually gotten into it.
I would have been a chef or a priest or an astronaut, which is what I wanted to be before this.
Because I definitely partially did movies because it was hard. You know, it's like
I was the same way. Now I'm old.
You
and
can't
I want to
be a filmmaker. That's difficult. Great challenge accepted. Let's do this.
Yeah. Well, back to synthetic cinema. So you got your start in horror flicks, but that's not what you're doing now. Can we talk a little bit about sort of the transition from where you started to what you're currently working
on? From horror to extreme horror, which is Christmas.
It was
kind of a natural transition. We went from, again, we're following the market, seeing what sells. We went from, you know, creature features sold, and then horror movies sold, and then it went to thrillers, and then it went to, you know, these dramas, drama thrillers, and now it's like at these Christmas movies, which can be a little fun. Because right now, you know, I know horror's still big, action's big, but people love, like, these Hallmark Lifetime Christmas movies. And some movies we make on our own, like, we fund them and sell them, and other ones we do for Hallmark, like, our direct, you know, Hallmark funds them, they're Hallmark movies. And, you know, they are very specific with what they want, because I think America, and I guess the world, they want warm, solid, fun, happy movies. And I think that's what a channel like Hallmark delivers. You know, it's something that you can feel comfortable watching. You know, you got these people that you almost connect to. I guess they're becoming like family because they have, like, you know, like repeated women and men that are in these movies. Like, even on the last film we shot in Old Weathersfield, everybody's like, oh, Alicia Witt, they're freaking out about her. And, you know, I know her from The Little Girl from Dune, the original movie, which the kids nowadays don't even know what Dune is. But, like, people are freaking out for Alicia Witt and, you know, Colin Ferguson and all these people. And even the movie we just premiered, Christmas at Pemberley Manor, all the audience wanted was the connection of, you know, Mr. Darcy and Emma, these two lead actors. They just loved when they looked at each other. Like, I was doing a live tweet and it's like, oh my God, they're like, oh my God, look at the look. It's like, wow.
You know. Based on Pride and Prejudice, right?
Yeah, it's loosely based on that. Yeah, that's the big comparison. But they also, Hallmark has something called like Mistletoe, Evergreens and Prejudice or something like that. They love Pride and Prejudice.
They do so much Pride and Prejudice.
But yeah, we kind of just followed the market. And that's where synthetic cinema went. And we're getting bigger and expanding and, you know, new people are getting involved because, you know, it's really a collaborative effort.
Well, let's talk about Wishin' and Hopin'. It's a film you did with Wally Lamb. Came out in 2014?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that. He's the New York Times bestselling author of She's Come Undone and Oprah Club book selection.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just talk about how it started. Then it's Colin's movie and let him do the real talk. I the way we got Wally Lamb was Wally Lamb was my English teacher in high school. And I believe it was the year he became famous. So I was the last year he had. So I actually had him in class and I submitted Wishing and Hoping to Lifetime for them to make, you know, and I kept pushing off. Then one year they're like, oh, let's go make this. And I was like, oh God, now I have to contact Wally Lamb. And so I went to Wally and I asked him and, you know, he's had all these great best-selling books and, you know, big guy, he's a nice guy. And we met at Ryan's Deli in Vernon and we talked about Wishing and Hoping. And I said, yeah, this will be the first movie being turned into, you know, first of his books being turned into a movie. And he went for it. And that's where we're introduced to Colin. And Colin can take it from there as far as Wishing and Hoping. So
yeah, talk a little bit about the synopsis. Because, I mean, it's a great, it was a best-selling book for him.
Yeah,
and
it's a novella.
I mean, yes. It got made in the context of Lifetime wanted to make a Christmas movie.
Yep, that was different.
That was different.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it is definitely different. It was a set at Christmas story about a 1960s Catholic school and a boy who went there and kind of his recollections of the things that happened that year. And it's got a little bit of a coming of age story. It's funny. It's got, you know, a lot of stories about the teachers and the kids and they're putting on a pageant and all the stuff that goes wrong. And it's, you know, it's a little deeper than that movie sounds like it would be. It touches on a lot of interesting subjects, some of which made it to the movie, some of which did not. It was nice because Wally is so well known and so well respected, they kind of let the script, when we initially sat down and talked about how to adapt the book, we were like, okay, how do we make this into a movie? And we're like, let's just literally like one-to-one translate it to a script. And then we went through and we're like, okay, we'll cut this and this. And that was it. And then like, it was a pretty straightforward process. I mean, John wrote it and I make it sound
John,
easier.
The creepy guy that I thought was like American Psycho.
Did the holiday
he wrote a good holiday film.
makes it sound easier than it really was, I'm sure. But it was a very linear adaptation. It was pretty much a straight translation of the book over to the script. And no one really messed with it at that stage.
No, and also it was one of his shorter books. Because yes, Wally's known for his 700 to 1,000 page books. And this was like, wasn't it like 200 pages or 180?
It was on the shorter side.
Yeah.
It was very appropriately sized for, you know, 90 minutes of story.
It was completely charming, though. And really, it's about kids. I mean, it's about this group of kids in the 60s, one boy in particular. And
Phoenix Funicello.
Yeah.
He's the cousin to Annette Funicello, I don't know if that's, you know, biographical to Wally Lamb.
No, it's not.
Made
up.
Yeah.
And people think that Wally is Felix.
Right.
Like, they all think and Wally will say it's not based on him at all.
So Molly Ringwald stars in that film. I mean, how did it come about that she became one of the featured actors in the film? And also very interesting, she has a French accent and she lived in France for a long time.
She
was that part of the consideration for her?
Well,
for the
I think
role?
In the book she was French Canadian, right?
Yes, yeah. French Canadian.
And that was, you know, when we went looking for actors, that was it. Like, a casting director picked out all the cast on that. And you're right, it's a great ensemble cast between Chevy Chase and Meatloaf and Sherry O'Terry and Conchita Farrell. I mean, it was a big cast, but it is funny. All I care about is the kids. You know, the kids weren't any big, big stars, but it's the kids that matter, and just the other cast just surrounded them.
Yeah, they really did. I mean, they do steal the show. They're wonderful. And there's also an Easter egg in that film for anybody who loved the movie 16 Candles, because one of the nuns is Molly Ringwald's older sister in the movie 16 Candles. Yep. It took me about Blanche halfway Baker. Through the movie and went, wait a minute.
And that was shot at that. By the way, the setting was North Free Academy, which is my high school and the school that Wally Lamb taught in. And that was shot during July on the third floor of a building. We had to bring in air conditioning because it was so hot.
Because
those schools did not have AC.
Yeah, and all the uniforms were wool, and they're, you know, Forky Chatter was dressed like a nun, and it was very hot.
How long did it take to film that movie?
Gosh, I don't even know.
24 days.
It was 24 days?
It
wow,
was.
That was a luxury. We get like
we
14
don't
days
anymore.
Now. We get like 14, 15 days.
Well, also it was because of all the children. I felt bad for Molly. At the end of most days, would end up just she was left, and she would be in the front of the room talking to nobody, because we'd have to shoot all kids out. So we bring in
the magic
one kid
of movies.
And, it was a lot of scheduling challenges from that perspective with the kids.
Yeah.
And you said after that was sort of the catalyst that brought you into the holiday film genre?
Yeah. It was, you know, that's one of my favorite films. That and actually Romance at Reindeer Lodge we just did last year, which was a movie that was insanely made fast. The entire movie was shot and delivered within 6 weeks. The entire film. was done. We got the green light to make Reindeer Lodge like the first week of November, and it was on the air December 18th or 19th. So it was, but it's funny, even though it was fast and crazy, it was one of my favorite experiences, and I liked the film too.
Yeah, because they kind of just told us to do it.
Yeah, it was like, just get this thing done. And yeah. We got it and done. And like you said, we were talking about earlier, Hallmark does Response Fest because they love their movies. They have good people working there that support, you know, the movies and the producers. So it's a really nice
and environment. They just let you work.
And then we did Christmas at Pemberley Manor and Christmas on Honeysuckle Lane. And then we have some other stuff coming up.
And that's where we're working right now, is on that one.
we're actually finishing up. We're finishing up Christmas on Honeysuckle Lane. It's going to be broadcast, I believe, November 24th.
So who stores all the Christmas decorations for the set then? Is it in your basement? Yeah, I can't.
I'm raising my hand. No, we do have one of the last films we did, Honeysuckle Lane, actually got a big Balsam Hill commercial contract through Hallmark because Balsam Hill's a decorator. They do Christmas stuff. I guess it's the best stuff in the world. They actually gave us product placement and had tons of Balsam Hill stuff in it, which was
beautiful.
I was
there the day that got dropped off and no one else was. I was in the office working on a different movie that didn't happen this year. And just me, and suddenly I hear this honk, and I go outside, and there's a tractor trailer truck, and the guy's like, I have all these boxes of Christmas stuff for you. I need to get it upstairs.
It's not going upstairs.
No, we carried it upstairs. Oh, we carried a tractor trailer truck's worth of boxes upstairs. And that was only the first load.
Yeah.
But right now the basement is literally packed floor to ceiling.
We have the entire basement of our building is filled with Christmas decorations. And also we have a storage space that's like 30 by 30 that's filled with Christmas. And we have wardrobe and, you know, standard props as well. But we do have a lot of Christmas.
So much Christmas.
But the Balsam Hill stuff all got sent back. Darn, because that stuff was really nice.
And recently on the Hallmark Channel, the movie Christmas at Pemberley Manor just came out.
Yep.
And that utilized in Essex, Connecticut.
Yeah, Essex and Old Lyme.
And you filmed on location. You actually used someone's home for that shoot. What was that like?
We usually do essentially exclusively location.
Yeah, we rarely do studio stuff unless it's for like green screen or something like that. We have to like green screen a killer crow or something like that.
What goes into choosing the locations?
It usually starts off with, because I know Connecticut and I've developed a lot of relationships with various business owners and towns. And what happens is I get thrown a script and real fast I look through the script and say, what are the top three or four locations? You know, what is it? And then I immediately think, where do I want to shoot this? Do I want to shoot it on the shore? Do I want to shoot it near Hartford? And we find our core, the big locations in one town. Like if we're shooting at a house and a park and a convenience store. I also want to find interesting, unique Connecticut locations. Because I know one of the reasons Hallmark works with us is because what's better than New England Christmas? Like nothing. And a lot of the stuff they shoot is in Canada or LA or Romania and doesn't quite fit that traditional Christmas. It looks great. Like the stuff looks awesome. But Connecticut is like New England and Connecticut is like the ultimate Christmas of when you see the Christmas cards and the paintings and all that. It's all definitely that. And we have the architecture for that.
Well, it is. It's, you know, Hallmark is really exploding. And holiday movies, as you were saying, more popular than ever. So is this kind of one of those things, well, strike where the iron, when the iron is hot?
Yeah, I think that's the thing is I think Christmas, I mean, Hallmark's been doing it for, I believe, a decade. It's only been getting bigger and bigger. And I think they know where to expand properly and where not to. So I think, obviously, Hallmark, I think, is the number one Christmas movie destination. They didn't pay me to say that. But it is the number one Christmas destination because the audience knows what they get. I mean, Lifetime is also good. But like a lot of these things like Netflix or Hulu, a lot of times they're acquired movies and it's kind of a mishmash of what is it? And those are the ones I think will kind of fall off a little.
I think as, you know, in terms of why we're doing them, you know, as a production company, the value of your company is the ability to finish a movie reliably and how good of a movie you can make. So, you know, the reason they say like ideas don't have a lot of value is like anybody can pitch ideas, us included, and everyone has ideas. If you didn't have ideas, you wouldn't be in the industry in the first place. What they'll pay for is who can actually deliver on an idea, whether it's yours, whether it's theirs, whatever it is. So, you know, Synthetic Cinema, we have a record, we make movies, they come out well, and they get done. So you know, that's why Hallmark or, you know, someone would come to us. And right now, the people who are hiring are making Christmas movies.
Yeah.
which are fun. Like, and like, and people I, are yeah. so excited for yeah. them. Like,
and
I'm not
it's
belittling them. Just saying, like, we go these, where the productions are.
We've done all these movies, and I'm telling you, my mom doesn't think I made it until the Hallmark movies. It's, we've done so many movies, and it's like people freak out about the Hallmark movies. Like, nobody cares about sci-fi or chiller or anything. It's like, oh yeah, you know, even like. You know, we did a movie with Drew Barrymore called Animal. It's like, oh, yeah, nobody cares. But it's like Hallmark. They're like, holy cow, you've hit the big time.
an actor a couple movies ago who, super nice guy. And he's like, you know what's funny? He's like, before this, I was an Army Ranger. And he's like, I've been in big shows, done, you know, theatrical movies. And he's like, but this is what all my relatives will get excited for.
Yeah,
and just Hallmark. This year he texts me, he's like, yeah, it was true.
But do you ever miss doing other genres? Do you want to go back to horror? I mean, is there the unfinished project or the project in the wings that you'd really like to work on?
We have a lot of, like any company, I think we have a lot of movies that are in ideas and development, some are in script. All different I love all movies. You know, they can be kids' movies, they can be monster movies, they can be slasher movies, they can be whatever. Like, I just like the whole aspect of movies. Like, I like the people working on them, I like developing them, I like finishing them, I like listening to the, you know, the sound mix, all this type of stuff. And so I'm into everything. You know, one of our dream projects is We Are Water with Wally Lamb, which we developed a script with Wally Lamb.
That's
so
a
we
good
have
script.
Wally's got this great, you know, multi-part HBO series that we're hoping will help fuel We Are Water, because he deserves, his movies are, I mean, his books are great. And now's the time for his books be turned to movies, because they're what people want. They're deep. They're what actors want to do. And I think, you know, HBO is going to do a great job, you know, on I Know This Much Is True. But I think people like Netflix and Hulu and Amazon would enjoy his other books being turned into, that's the pitch for We Are Water, for people to fund it. You know, but We Are Water is a perfect movie to do. But we have other, we do have some horror stuff. We do have some thrillers that we're trying to get to that we can never get to. I mean, we have projects that we are greenlit to go, that we just got to find the time and where to make them and all types of stuff. So we are going to get to everything, and next year is going to be a lot of stuff.
And one of the nice things about the history we have had is getting to work on different genres and all the different types of movies. It's been, you know, it's fun to change them up. And, you know, you always, after you do a few things of a certain, you know, in a certain vein, you do want to try something else. But yeah, we'd love to make whatever.
Yeah.
We have, obviously, everyone here, We Are Water is an excellent example, but we all have things that we have championed or written or pitched, even if we didn't actually write, that we would love to make and hope for the opportunity to do it sometime.
And what's yours?
Oh, gosh. I mean, well, that one. Let's go with that one right now. But, I mean, we have literally stacks. I've probably pitched 500 movies. Yeah. In the past, you know,
I mean, my dream job would be the showrunner for Doctor Who next season, or the showrunner for a Ghostbusters Netflix series. And after I do that, I can just die.
Everybody seems to be a critic these days. A lot of trolls on social media. It's a call out culture. When you produce something, I think it's probably a piece of art. It's part of you. It's your creativity. It's your effort. It's your vision. Is there bad stuff? Do you read it?
The trolls are the fun ones. Yeah. I mean, we get a lot of social media on whenever the movie premieres, you get a lot of social media. I mean, at first, our biggest social media was Stalker's Prey, which is a killer shark stalker movie for a lifetime. Had huge social media. But then we got to Pemberley Manor, which aired on Friday on the 27th. That was huge. It was number 12 in the nation as far as like Twitter. And I just got the ratings, actually. That's why I've been looking at my phone. The ratings are huge.
Nice.
They're like, it's like the number one cable show on Friday, which is good. It's like 3.57 million live viewers.
Wow.
It's huge. And it's higher than, they put the football above it, but it's, the number's high.
Sure.
But the football did not get more viewers. They got more in their demographic,
right.
But ours is the biggest thing on cable, which
wow.
is awesome.
That's my negative press. There has been some really
negative
fun
press.
Negative press.
There has, yeah,
and
negative
that doesn't
press.
That doesn't bother you?
Oh, God, oh, no. I love no, it no. because they're thinking about the same things I'm thinking about.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, we know what's wrong with movies probably more than anyone else does. But actually, the funniest ones, the Hallmark people, like,
they love their
the
movies.
Audience loves it. Like,
which is
it's
awesome.
The most positive. It's almost weirdly positive, like people just quoting it and with like heart emojis. The best ones for hatred were the early like monster movies.
Yeah.
I used to know when a movie came out in another country because, like, I mean, you don't know, like, no one tells you it's happening. It's just like one day it's out. Because like I'd get emails from like 12-year-old boys in England telling me I should kill myself. And I'm like, oh, I guess it came out in the UK.
And that was me.
But that, I mean, I guess you have to have a thick skin in this business. You can't. You have to let it roll off your back.
I used to really get angry about stuff when I was younger. Now it's like I don't even care because I think it's fun. But it is nice to go off of what Colin said. It is nice to see a group of people who love these movies, like when it genuinely, like they love the settings or they love the relationships. Like that is nice to see that this is what made their night. You know, because they're touching people with these movies. Like this is what's making their night, and Hallmark is making the whole 2 months for these people that love these movies. And some of the scripts are obviously similar to stuff they've done before, but it's always kind of new with the settings and the actors and everything.
But do you think part of the appeal right now, especially, is that
it's escapism? Kind
of, yeah. Exactly. I mean, I think the appeal is that it takes you out of everyday life, and anybody who's watching the news or it's depressing. And yeah. So I think that there has to be a sort of it's like, again, striking while the iron is hot. It's, it's a great time to be making films that take people out of their everyday lives.
Yeah.
Because we're all looking to escape.
Yeah.
And so are there projects you can talk about that are currently percolating that
are coming up? Well,
yeah.
There is more Christmas stuff coming up, and there is
I wish it was Christmas all the time.
Yeah, it's going to be Christmas all the time. There is, I know We Are Water is one of our dream ones, and I know coming up, I can't say much about it, but this coming year, we are actually shooting a movie in Iceland. Though I love Connecticut, we do have a lot coming to Connecticut, but you know, Iceland's going to be huge. It makes us, I think it's going to be cool to be in a different country. And we're going to get all the glaciers and the waterfalls
right.
And the northern lights and all that
type
of stuff.
One of the things that does get tiresome with Christmas stuff, because we're not shooting in the winter ever, you have to be very restrictive in what you frame, right? Like you're always looking at which direction looks the least like June.
Exactly.
which is no direction.
Right. Yeah. You're standing, you like look around, you're like, okay, like I got like 10 degrees this way and like I can shoot into that bush. And then that's a shed and it's ugly, but at least it's not a tree. And like that, you have to stage your scene around that. So it would be nice to shoot somewhere where it's, or at some time when like you could be like, okay, I can show this beautiful shot of this actual thing that's actually here, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Iceland, you can't take a bad photo. Really, it's legitimately, you could take a picture of the grass and it's like, wow, this is amazing. Yeah. You know, and that's the whole thing.
And we're excited if we do, you know, one of these Christmas movies in January. New England in the winter is literally exactly what all these postcards and like Norman Rockwell paintings they reference actually look like. And so it's like if we actually had that real environment, it would look great.
But we still might have to make fake snow. Because you know, right. Connecticut, like, there might not be snow. There might be snow and it's great, but sometimes the snow gets ugly after 24 hours. So we'll probably have to make fake snow, but at least now we can shoot trees and stuff like that.
That's always the killer.
Easy enough.
Well, and speaking of snow, I was going to ask, which one of you is responsible for the snow in June? I noticed it was snowing at the end of Christmas at Pemberley Manor, so that had to be CG. Was that you?
There was a whole team of CG people.
A whole team of CG people,
yeah.
The 90 artists. And
the team that did the special effects for Pemberley Manor and for Very Nutty Christmas are four times the size of the team that made the movie.
Yeah. The snow is a really big deal. Like, it's really hard to do.
It was hard to tell that it wasn't real.
And there's stuff that people won't even notice. I mean, some stuff is, you can tell, is CG, but other stuff like paint outs in the background and stuff, people wouldn't notice because
it's interesting that
stuff.
I used to do a lot of special effects, and I still do some, but it used to be a big passion of mine. And over time, it's changed from an industry focused on creating a spectacle to an invisible industry focused on making something look fit the story, which is nice from a storytelling perspective, but annoying from a VFX perspective. But like, you know, I was saying about Christmas movies, and like, if we're trying to shoot, like, we had the Town Green in Essex, and it was supposed to be snowy in the winter, and I'm like, we might as well shoot this on the moon.
Yeah,
like it has nothing to do with what this actual place looks like, because it is virtually a rainforest. Like everywhere you look, it's green. The grass is green, the trees are green, there's green bushes framing us on all sides.
Flowers on everything.
There's flowers on everything. You know, we literally
there, there,
shot
white,
it
there
in
was
barn,
white flowers like, on some of the trees that we just kind of left and looked like snow.
Yeah, and we turned so the pink ones white. Yeah. You know, they kind of look like snow. Shoot it very soft focus.
I mean, what is the biggest challenge in what each of you do? I mean, there's probably the honest answer and then the political answer.
Over the years, you know, there's always, after every movie, we kind of like, the core group kind of gets together and like, what did we do right? What did we do wrong? And there are some consistencies of what went wrong or what went right, but a lot of times it's just, you know, sometimes things will go great in one department, but the next show will be horrible. So it's just a matter of trying to keep my jokes are trying to keep everybody happy, keep everything on time, keep everything on budget. But this whole endeavor should be about the movie. But probably 60% of my time is spent on individual issues, ego issues, or catering issues, or like the stuff that doesn't really matter to the movie. I mean, catering does matter and everything's great, but it's like, you know, you're doing this expensive big catering and you have lots of different people and it's like, you have a problem with like a chip? You know, and literally my mind, instead of focusing on like, oh, this needs to look great in the snow, it's like, oh my God, my guacamole's too old.
Feed 60 people.
What are we worried about here?
It's
like, it's kind of ridiculous.
It's a lot of putting out fires.
Yeah, it's a lot of putting out fires that don't matter.
Yeah.
It's like I understand a real fire. Like, I love actual problems, like a real problem I like dealing with. But when it's a fake problem, which I put towards people's like egos or the way they do stuff, that doesn't make sense.
And people go from zero to panic too fast.
It's unbelievable. I like real problems. I don't like pseudo problems. Yeah.
But also even on a actual on-set filmmaking perspective, like most of the job of directing is time management and like thinking about what the company is doing and what each department has to do and shuffling and organizing your day such that you're getting the maximum amount out of each scene instead of just what you're doing right now. So it's like you might have to shortchange the shot you're taking right now or the scene you're doing now because 6 hours from now you're doing a scene and you want to leave room for that. So it's an organizational shuffle, kind of on the fly live thing. But like I said, the hard part is, you know, you can make that day. Like, I'll figure out how to do it. I'll get all the shots by the end of the day to make sure you don't ruin the movie in doing it.
Last question, any close calls? I mean, you're on deadlines, you know that the movie's going to be airing on whatever the given date is, and you're doing a pretty quick turnaround. Any close calls where you were worried it just wasn't going to happen?
Oh, no. Always.
We had different opinions. I mean, I think they've all been close calls, but I think we've always delivered. I don't know, what was the closest? Was it Reindeer Lodge? Was like three or four days?
I mean, I guess the thing is you always leave the time in so that even if you do have that close call, like, you have the second chance.
Yeah, we only give ourselves really a second chance. Oh. It's only like even with Pemberley Manor, it was delivered on a Friday. It was Friday, Saturday. That next Saturday is when it was on the air. So we had time. If there's something drastically wrong, we'd have time to redeliver one more time. But that's pretty typical now. It's not like something like, oh, most people I think would freak, but now it's become pretty typical
The tight post-production turnaround. I mean, there are always things on set where something seems catastrophic. Yeah. But the tightest turnarounds in post do leave you sweating.
So, generally speaking, you're not lying in bed anymore staring at the ceiling in abject terror?
That happens all the time.
I did pull two all-nighters this weekend to get this last movie delivered on Monday. So, of course, it would have been okay if I hadn't. It was just that last stuff that I was like, I can make this a little better.
Yeah. No, there is, like, my phone's always ringing or texts or emails 24 hours a day. It's bound to happen, especially with three movies going at once and other stuff in development.
So people aren't great about like perspective or boundaries.
No, I always get the call at like 9 o'clock at night that again, like zero to nightmare. And it's like some tiny thing's got to be changed. It's like, well, it's going to happen.
There's a hair on her coat.
Yeah, it's going to happen the next day. Like, it's not going to happen at 9 o'clock on Connecticut. I can't get anybody. Yeah. So it is what it is.
Putting out fires.
Yeah.
And identifying actually fires.
Yeah, I just let them burn sometimes. And then they naturally go out.
We've been talking to Colin Thays and Andrew Gernhard of Synthetic Cinema International. I'm Sarah Lemire, and this is Hack the Chat, produced by Bill Ahern and Sarah Lemire at Tapeworks Incorporated in Hartford, Connecticut.